طب من
Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, with live streaming on dublincityfm.ie. Inside Education is your weekly mix of news and stories from the world of education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'm glad you can tune in. To contact the programme with comments or suggestions, you can email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation, all one word, at dublincityfm.ie. You can text the programme at 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665. You can listen to previous Inside Education programmes on our website. That is www.insideed.com. That's www.insideed.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at InsideEd. Later in the programme, I'll bring you an interview with Professor John Coulihan, Professor Emeritus of Education at NUI Maynooth, to mark the publication of his new book on Ireland's Inspectorate. But as always, we begin by taking a look back at the news stories about education from the last week. And to do this, I'm joined by Barry Hennessy. Welcome to the programme, Barry.
Hello again, Sean.
Barry, junior cert results were released this week and the Minister did more than just congratulate the students on their results.
Indeed, Minister for Education Pat O'Keefe is asking the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment to examine junior cycle education in other countries to see what changes could be brought in here in Ireland. The Minister has expressed concerns about rote learning in the system. Now, it's likely the NCCA will be informed in its deliberations by research already carried out by the ESRI. The government's think tank has been carrying out a survey of students' experiences of post-primary education over recent years. A number of publications have already been published, including one called Gearing Up for the Exam, The Experiences of Junior Cert Students, and that was published in 2007. Now, the main findings of that study were that the junior cert year, third year, means that students have less time to spend on fun activities in the classroom, and that for some this can lead to them becoming more negative about their school experience. The exam focus in third year also leads quite a number of students to take grinds, but the majority of students who do so tend to come from middle class backgrounds, thus inserting some inequality into the system. It's also been revealed in the study that those students attending streamed schools, in other words schools where students are banded by ability, students in lower ability streams tend to achieve less well, and of course the fact that they have less access to higher level subjects limits their choices when it comes to senior cycle. So it's likely that all in all the Minister, based on what he's already said with regard to his concerns about rote learning, will try to make the junior cert less focused on traditional rote learning, probably somewhat more equal in terms of reducing the disparity in outcomes between those who take grinds and those who don't, and also perhaps a junior cycle system that is less limiting of students' options once they come to senior cycle.
And will everyone be happy with this change, Barry?
Well, obviously not everybody, but is everybody ever happy with anything? But on a serious level, I suppose, there will definitely be some who will argue that the junior cert provides some focus or sense of purpose to junior cycle students, perhaps boys in particular. But also, of course, many teachers who are currently feeling the brunt of education cutbacks and the pension levy in their own pockets will be less than well disposed, one imagines, to cooperate in a radical reform of the education system at a time where already there are various directives in force in staff rooms as a direct response to what teachers regard as, I suppose, some of the what they would see as the unfair elements of recent government decisions.
Okay, so it'll be interesting to see how that one unfolds in the coming months. The evenings are getting shorter and Conor na Gaeilge would like people to enrol in some of their courses.
Well, as the autumn evenings begin to close in, there's a chance you've given a little thought to night classes. Languages are among the most popular choices available to those interested in adult education, and our first national language enjoys perennial popularity. Conor na Gaeilge have been offering courses in Irish for the best part of a century, so you could say they've more than a little experience in their field. Sheena Nick O'Neill of Conor na Gaeilge told us more about the courses on offer.
this term we've actually got 9 different levels altogether on offer, and it caters for everybody in Dublin, everybody's capabilities, if you will. If you're a complete beginner coming into the language, we have 2 entry classes for that one, but it's also there for people who want to have the cupola focal maybe and want to brush up on that, right up to, I suppose, fluent speakers that want to also look at their grammar, maybe just to perfect some of the grammatical questions maybe that have been eluding them so far, that they should get looking mokinilik and all the rest of it. But it's there for everybody, and it's quite aura-based. We would have a lot of conversation is the key focus for us, to get people back into speaking the language as well, and then if they have any questions that they can ask all the teachers. So that will be starting up now on the week of the 21st of September, and so we're quite excited trying to get everything all organised for that, particularly for people who have lost their jobs and maybe have that little bit of time to spare and are looking to upskill themselves and to have something to put on the CV. In 2003 there was legislation that came through about the Official Languages Act, which means that all the official bodies, state bodies, have to provide services Osquelge for people looking for them. So it means that if you do brush up on your Irish and you find that you can put that on your CV straight away, somebody knows, is looking at you and saying that they're getting kind of a 2-for-1 value. You can do your job in English, certainly fluently, I'm sure, but also that you can now do it in Irish as well.
A group of Wicklow students, Barry, are in pole position for a major international event this week.
Now, it might seem like a long way from engineering class in school tomorrow morning to glittering award ceremonies with the likes of Lewis Hamilton and Bernie Eccleston, but that's exactly what awaits a group of Greystones teams this week. Team Coney Cats, as they're known, are past winners of the Irish leg of F1 in schools, and this week sees them travel to London, where the car they created will take on rivals from up to 30 other countries. Back home, meanwhile, entries are now being accepted for this year's competition, run under the auspices of the Irish Computer Society. Gillian Harty from F1 in Schools told us more.
It's an exciting competition run by ourselves that challenges secondary school students to design, build and race model Formula One cars. They're powered by compressed air canisters and made of balsa wood, which is very light wood. So, I mean, imagine designing and engineering your own F1 car and then racing it against, you know, other teams from your school and other schools around the country. So just to give you an idea of the kind of excitement, you're racing a kind of 25-centimetre car made from balsa wood, designed by yourself, shot down a 20-metre track in approximately a second. So they're going extremely fast. So we would run competitions around the country. So students around the country are designing their model cars using 3D design software. And over the coming months, the cars will get manufactured by colleges and universities. And then all the student teams will come together at regional events where they'll compete against other students. So they race their car, but there's also other elements of the competition, you know, a kind of engineering portfolio and a verbal presentation. The registration is now open, and all registration is online on www.f1inschools.ie, and it'll be open till mid-October, 16th of October.
And thanks to Barry Hennessy for bringing us up to date with news from the world of education. My name is Sean Delaney, and you're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. The Kigara has been a key feature of schools for many years. Brian McMahon describes how in one town, the local hotel porter and Hackney driver were roped into an elaborate warning system to teachers to let them know that an inspector was in the area. Although such warning systems are mostly a thing of the past, relatively little has been documented about the role of the inspectorate in Irish education. Until recently, that is. The Four Courts Press has just published A History of Ireland's School Inspectorate 1831 to 2008. The book, which was written by Professor John Coulihan with Patrick F. O'Donovan, is the first published history of Ireland's school inspectorate. I took the opportunity of the publication of this book to speak to Professor Coulihan. When I met up with him, I began by asking him to describe how the book came to be written.
The chief inspector asked me in 2005 if I could take this job on. And I knew that it was a gap in our historiography of Irish education, because they were such an important and intimate part of the development system. And at the same time, there was literally almost nothing published on them. There was a small booklet on the early inspectorate, but scarcely an article published on them. So that kind of surprised me when I went and looked. There was so little to draw upon. I was also a bit uneasy. I was pretty confident that source material for the 19th and early 20th century was pretty strong, but I wasn't so sure that we had been as careful with archives and documentation in the post-independence period. So I was a bit uncertain for a while. But I was very glad to think, as I walked through it, through the archives in the DES, in the National Archives themselves, which are very interesting, various departments, in the university libraries, and in, you know, National Library, of course, and so on, that I did manage to uncover a lot of material that allowed me to do what I think is a fairly coherent and cohesive account of all the inspectorates. And I think a lot of new material has come to the surface as well. I think that it throws light as well as on the inspectorate. I think we learn an awful lot about the Department of Education itself, but also maybe more importantly about the overall system.
When Professor Coulihan was answering that question, he referred to inspectorates in the plural. This was because for many years the primary, post-primary and vocational inspectorates were separate, and they have really only been united since the 1990s. The primary inspectorate is by far the oldest, dating back to 1832 and the establishment of the national school system. The primary inspectorate that was initially put in place was based on an earlier inspection system set up by the Kildare Place Society. For many years there was tension between primary teachers and inspectors because of the system of paying teachers by their students' results.
That really emerged in the context of a wide debate in Britain, where laissez-faire ideology was very strong, and there was a feeling that the state was contributing to education and that perhaps it didn't have enough accountability for the expenditure. And in the 1860s, 1862, it was established in England the payment by results system, whereby the salaries of teachers were completely dependent on the performance of the pupils at the annual examinations conducted by the inspectors. Now, in Ireland, of course, it was also mooted, and eventually it came into operation fully in Ireland in 1872, just 10 years later. And it was championed very much by a man called Patrick Keenan, who later became Sir Patrick Keenan, who in 1871 became the resident commissioner. He had been a very distinguished inspector before that. And the system operated in Ireland, but not as crudely as it did in England. In Ireland, the teacher still remained a basic salary, a certification salary, as they called it, and the payment by results was an extra bonus on that basic salary. But it did create tensions between the inspectors and the teachers because, as time went on, teachers realised that their emoluments, their salaries, their payments, depended on the results examinations, and a great deal dependent how the inspector did all that. And likewise, their promotion prospects became dependent on the report of the inspectors as well. So, of course, the visit of inspectors then tended to be, by and large, fairly tension-ridden, because there was so much at stake for the teachers at a time when salaries were low anyway. And that continued for a long time in different ways. Even when payment by results was abolished in 1900, the inspectors still had a huge impact on teacher increments and teacher promotion. So in many ways, it did create that tension, which sometimes, you know, in teacher folklore, you'd often find teachers having fairly bad memories of the inspectorate, you know, in a sense. But in later times, that is dissolved, and there's now much more professional cooperation and flexibility and, I think, mutual regard.
But have inspectors been too slow in taking action against underperforming teachers?
In any system where you have, we'd say, so many hundreds, tens of thousands of people involved, you're bound to get people who are not performing extraordinarily well, or maybe as well as they should. Likewise, it's a long career path. You know, people join the career often at 20 or 22, 23, and they may be often there until 65. And over a life cycle, people run into various problems and issues. So it has been a problem, and during the Education Convention and other issues there during the 90s, we focused on that issue. And also in some of the recent partnership agreements, there's been a tightening up of this situation. Furthermore, the idea of getting a support service for teachers who do run into difficulties, like, you know, the various maybe breakdown or psychological problems, or, you know, hardship, accidents at home, bereavements and so on and so forth, where people need a bit of support at times, running into these aspects of what the human condition is. I think that has improved as well, where there is some support services for teachers in trouble. But in general terms, I think it's something that was laxly handled for a period. There was a question, a little bit of drift attached to it. I have felt for a good while it needed a better tightening up and a better professional support all round. And I always felt it was a combination of the department and the teacher unions and the management, more than perhaps the parents' issue, but that those three agencies, I thought, should have liaised more effectively in that regard.
And even, I suppose, principals, they probably have a difficult role in that because, on the one hand, they're colleague, but they're also ultimately responsible for the quality of teaching in a school.
Absolutely the case. Particularly in the Irish context, where so many of the primary schools, in any case, have tended to be small by international standards. Small schools with, you know, three or four teachers at times, and obviously close intimacy in a small village area, etc. So I think myself it was always a bit unrealistic to think that the principal could take a very... he or she has a role to play in watching the performance and so on. But nevertheless, when it comes down to serious action on an inefficient teacher, I think too much weight was placed on the principal that other agencies, in theory it might sound okay, you're the leader and so on, but in the circumstances and the culture of rural Ireland, I think it was a bit, should we say, a theoretical approach.
One notable feature of the inspectorate until the 1990s was that despite the large number of women teachers, the inspectorate remained a male-dominated profession. I asked Professor Coulihan why that was.
It's a very good question, because it carried on so much longer than we would expect. In Irish society generally, from the early 70s, having joined the EEC, women's rights became much more established in society. Up to then, for instance, women in the civil service had to retire on marriage and so on. And of course, national teachers had to retire on marriage. That was lifted in 1958. It was brought in 1933. So there was that thing against women in the system, which was somehow or other, I think, a very backward attitude. But I think the real reason was more linked to the nature of the work. And that for a long time, inspectors were shifted areas. They weren't allowed to stay in the same area for a very long time. They might be, for say, in West Cork, and it could be West Galway, and they could be shifted to Donegal or through the Midlands or whatever the case might be. And at that time, that was seen as kind of a lot of upheaval, particularly for females in the context of their responsibilities for children and so on. In a society where there was less equality, women carried the major burden on child nurture and care. And I think that in terms of that lifestyle, likewise, of course, the inspectors didn't have the holiday situations of teachers, which were linked, of course, to the school children. In the case of the inspectors, they were civil servants, and they were expected to be on call. The hours were quite long. The work was very demanding at times, I assure you, from the records. I can see people working on Saturdays and Sundays and in the evenings getting their reports in. There was an extraordinary amount of reportage and accountability and bureaucracy. And I think as a way of life, it didn't appeal very much to females. But as you say, for the last 10 or 12 years in particular, I think there are more women inspectors now than men.
Although on the subject of, you know, the long hours and so on that inspectors put in, they were remunerated, at least in the early days, handsomely, where an inspector could earn up to 10 times the salary of a teacher.
Yes, in the original conception of the inspector's role, there was a very clear distinction drawn between inspectors and teachers. Inspectors were seen as gentlemen who were expected to have a status when they would be meeting managers of schools or other authorities in society. They were expected to have a status, and accordingly they were paid very well. As you say, in the early years they could maybe get 300, in the 1830s they might get £300 a year plus some expenses, whereas the average salary for a teacher at the time might be 30. So the gap was very, very large indeed, and of course the inspectorate had a certain social status and cachet. They were expected also, of course, to live a lifestyle that was giving no cause for scandal or anything like that. And they had to, of course, stay in the proper lodgings, and they were encouraged not to arrive in school on foot, that they needed to have horses or carriages or by train or whatever the case might be. So there was that distinction, and it lasted for a long time, really. It's only in the modern era whereby there was much, much more commonality. In some cases, for a while, for instance, inspectors were leaving the service because teachers were better paid. So the situation changed. And nowadays, it's a very different situation, isn't it? You know, there may be here and there slight differences, but very often a principal teacher might have more than an inspector today.
So where is the influence of the inspectorate most evident in the education system we have today?
I think a very valuable redefinition of the inspector's role occurred in the Education Act of 1998, where it highlighted that the key role was the promotion of quality of education and the evaluating that quality and reporting on it, quality assurance of the system, and policy advice to the administration on new developments and appropriate trends, etc. These are the two key pillars. Now, they'll do many other things as well, and they're called upon to do many other things. But I think that clear definition did a great deal to, redirect a role that had become maybe over diversified, to give it a greater sense of strategic mission. I think in terms of quality, the whole school evaluation system, it appears to me, is a very good approach. The encouragement of school planning, also the manner of the whole school evaluations, whereby it takes into account the circumstances of school, management issues, the socio-economic environment, and so on, where also it has been encouraging schools to be self-evaluators, to do their own evaluation. In other words, they are stimulants, if you like, but their key concern is for the school and the professionals on the ground to be on the alert themselves, and then use the inspectors, if you like, as aides and assistants from time to time, external monitors of the system. And I think, bearing in mind it's only about 10 years in operation, it has moved very well, and I think it's delivered very well. At the moment, for instance, there's over 3,000 reports on schools in the website, the department's website, which is a very new thing. They produce a great lot of high quality publications which are valuable to all the stakeholders in the system, and they're, I think, very much closely involved now with the policy makers, the administrators in the department. There's a close liaison there, and I think that is nothing but a good development.
I also asked Professor Coulhan how he sees the role of the inspectorate evolving in the next 10 or 20 years.
Building on what they're doing at the moment, which is a great reliance on whole school inspections, subject inspections, probationary inspections, all of which are well reported on now and followed up, relinking back to schools, particularly encouraging schools to do their own planning and their own self-evaluations and become professionals with their antennae highly focused on the actual environment in which they work themselves. This, I think, is a very good professional development. Likewise, I think the inspector's role in the policy arena has become much more direct, much more influential. And likewise, their links with their international peers, I think, have helped to keep international insights and international trends to the fore. So I would think it has a good development. I gather there's going to be cut back in numbers because of the new economic stringency, but hopefully it won't do too much damage, because I think a great deal has been achieved in reorganising the inspectorate for the purpose of the 21st century.
I then took the opportunity to ask Professor Coulhan to look back over his long and distinguished career and to tell me what he considers to have been the most significant changes in education during this time.
Yeah, it has been a long career. It's just 50 years since I went to the training college in 1959. So it's been a very interesting 50 years to observe the education system, and I've been very privileged to be a part of it, because I worked as a primary and a secondary and a vocational teacher and a further education teacher, training college teacher, university teacher, and so on. So it gave me a good chance to see the insides of the system, and I feel very privileged about that. And looking back overall, I must say I think we've made great strides. In the early 60s, our system was very old-fashioned, outdated, massively under-resourced, and the quality at times was very poor in many areas. It was okay for a small group of children who did fairly well in secondary schools and gone on to university and so on. But for the vast majority, I thought then the movements in the 60s, the reform and the movements, it was great to be a young teacher then, because the investment education reports come in, the opening up of the school, the movement of new curriculum, the opening up of improving teacher education, the opening up of higher education, the grants for higher education. It was really a tremendously heady period of change and development and reform. And I think there was a great, buoyancy in so many aspects of the system. And by and large, there was a dip, of course, from the middle 70s through the 80s, because a lot of plans couldn't be done. Particularly the 80s became very discouraging, because because I was involved in a lot of reports and so on, all of which seemed to be gathering dust and weren't being acted upon. And there was a regression set in the system, disimprovements of pupil-teacher ratio, somewhat like we're experiencing again or beginning to experience. But nevertheless, I think the other great period, apart from the 60s and early 70s, was the 90s and into the new century. And again, we got a great grip in the system, as I was saying earlier on. A whole new sense of partnership was evolved, a new dynamism was set afoot. There was tremendous consultation. I think it was almost unique in the world, the amount of reform that came up from a bottom-up, or at least a bottom-across perspective, not just top-down, and where we got so much agreement on three government white papers, 1995, and the one on early childhood, and the one on adult education. That hadn't ever happened before. We got an extraordinary amount of education legislation, the Education Act of 1998, the first comprehensive education act ever in Ireland, the University Act of 1997, and a host of other legislation in more recent periods, the setting up the Teaching Council, the state exam boards, and the opening up of so many opportunities at higher education for so much of the people, that now you have up to about 60% of the people going on to third level education in one form or another. And I think it's been a great story. The only hope now is that that can be maintained. I think we could have used some of our resources from the middle 90s to 2005 a bit better in the priorities, certain aspects of education. But nevertheless, at least we got a bit better grip on research, and that was very important for the society and economy in general. And by and large, it's been a great period. There've been, should we say, the two great periods for me were the middle 60s, middle 70s, middle 90s to 2005 or so. And what one hopes is that that vitality can be sustained and we do not lose ground, you know, in the way ahead, because education is so crucial for the future of our society in all its aspects, not just economic, but social, cultural and social cohesion and so on.
And what would you say were some of the missed opportunities maybe in the mid-90s?
I think we had an extraordinary agenda for change that was generated in a way perhaps exemplary for any country, whereby we brought, as I say, three government white papers to the fore. But to a very large degree, government white papers are supposed to be government decisions for action. But if you examine those three white papers, particularly the early childhood and the adult education one, you'll find the momentum for action got lost. You got a range of different ministers coming in who didn't seem to want to know the work of the previous ministers. I thought it was a bit ridiculous. One minister in the early part of this century felt he needed to go around the country in a whole campaign to find out what needed to be done in education, even though his own government had produced three white papers on education.
Here, Professor Coulhan is referring to Minister Noel Dempsey's initiative entitled Your Education System.
That, I think, was ground lost. The focus and the concentration from about 2001 forward was not maintained at a time when we had the resources to really make some further interventions that could have been landmarks, you know.
You've mentioned there, the Minister for Education, you know, as a position, the Department of Finance, conventions on education, researchers and practitioners. Looking back on all of those over your career, where do you think change in education comes from? And where should it come from?
I think I wouldn't look at any one source. I think what was crucial there was a combination of the groups coming together, like in the 90s, where the researchers and the administrators and the other bodies which had now been established, like the parents' groups, etc., and the principal groups, etc., could be brought into the dialogue. Where I think a marvellous initiative was that by Niamh Brannock and Don Thornhill, the secretary at the time, in convening the National Education Convention, where on the light of various papers which had been prepared, green papers and so on, and submissions by all the groups, you had a consultative forum, full-time forum for 2 weeks with 42 of the key stakeholders involved in a structured way that hammered out a remarkable consensus in educational change, which made it more or less child's play for the white paper in 1995, because there was so much ownership cultivated from that debate. So it's not so much looking to just one sector, but it's when you get the synergies of them all combining, you're on a winner. And that was remarkable.
And to find out more about the story of Irish inspectors and about Irish education in general, you can read John Coulihan's new book. It is called A History of Ireland's School Inspectorate, 1831 to 2008. He wrote it with Patrick O'Donovan and it's published by Four Courts Press. It costs €50 in hardback, with a €5 discount if you buy it on the Four Courts website. That's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. If you have comments or suggestions for the programme, you can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can text me on 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665. If you miss a programme, there are podcasts of previous programmes on the website. That is www.insideed.com. That's www.insideed.com. Thanks to Barry Hennessy for his news roundup, and thanks to Professor John Coulihan for giving me an extended interview. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.